Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks very much for listening on Friday, June 19th, 2015. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week. Normally, they're chosen by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week, I have one expert in the world of the federal government and one warm body. It's Keith Trippi of the Trippi Group, formerly of the Department of Homeland Security. It's great to see you, my friend.
Francis, good to see you.
Thank you very much. And I'm the warm body. It was a recruitment failure on my part because it's a terrific weekend, and we're in the summer season.
I saw a bunch of cars going the other way as I was coming this way.
That's right. People shrieking and headed for the beach. So I'm very pleased that you're here, and you've made terrific choices for your selections for the Federal News Countdown. I picked out three stories, too, and we can talk about those. And we'll start where we always do with
number three.
And your choice at the third most important federal news story of the week is from WBIR.com, a television station, and its headline, Retired Tennessee Canine Survives Cancer Thanks to Clinical Trial. This is a cool connection that you're making here. What is it, Keith?
All right, so just looking at the article, you'd say, what does this have to do with the federal government?
I did that yesterday, as a matter of fact.
I'm sure you did. Well, it turns out quite a bit. So, you know, having a 13-year-old Labrador myself, this story rang true to me. And the basic gist of the story is there was a 14-year-old dog that got sick. And if it weren't for a clinical trial that the owners were able to hunt down and find out about, it didn't come to them. They had to hunt down and find it out. A long journey to take the dog, to go get the dog healed up. And so if it weren't for that clinical trial, the dog would have died, you know, a treasured member of the family.
Yes.
So here's the connection, and here's the point that I'm trying to make. My father worked for a large pharmaceutical company for years, and the amount of time it takes for a drug coming out of R&D to hit the shelves could be 5, 10, 15 years going through the process to get that done. If you're talking about one of the drugs where the two people are sitting in the bathtubs as the sun's setting,
yes,
who cares, right, if that takes 15 years? What I'm talking about
here
is...
Well, if you're one of the guys sitting in the bathtub and wants to get in the other bathtub, then you care a lot, but I get your point.
So if I'm sitting there and I've got lung cancer or I've got heart disease or I've got some ailment that the doctor says you have 6 to 12 months to live, I do not want to hear that a clinical trial is going to take 5 years. Mm-hmm. That is going to do me no good.
Right.
So the case that I'm trying to make here with this article is the opportunity for the federal government to leverage disruptive technologies in clinical trials. The genesis of the problem typically is people don't know that clinical trials are going on. Mm-hmm. Yes, the government has created a site that ends in a .gov that allows people to go find the clinical government trials that are happening. Mm-hmm. The problem is people don't know where to go if they happen to know of the website. All I'm saying, flip the model around the same way when you go to Harris Teeter and Harris Teeter knows that you want shampoo and it's going to give you a 20-cent coupon. Mm-hmm. Find me with my interests in things that I care about. Allow me to register for this information and come notify me. That is one piece of the process that is absolutely broken. Another piece of the process after I found out about it is, well, what's the process that I need to go through as I get started? And typically that's the recruitment process, right? So I found out about it. Now walk me through the steps to come and get into the program. Mm-hmm. And then do I qualify for the program? And then the consent process. The consent process, if you went to Harvard Law School, can of corn. Within 3 weeks, you'll have it figured out. Mm-hmm. If you're somebody like me from Arkansas, it's going to take you a long time to read it, and you still don't know if you want to put the pen to paper. Mm-hmm. Those three steps can take years. And the problem is you get people dropping out of the program. And so what happens? The drug manufacturers don't learn what they need to know. Mm-hmm. And all the while, you've got folks that may have had a chance that don't have a chance because of a 5 to 10 year process. Isn't working.
I love the notification and information concept that you're talking about there. Yep. It strikes me that there are two factors: data analytics to be able to understand who the people are that are interacting with the healthcare providers at their local levels, and then information sharing. How do you get that information to the hands of the people who are doing the studies in a timely way, in a secure way, that also respects the privacy of the people that are involved? I'm not suggesting none of those are doable.
Right.
I'm just thinking through some of the things that will also have to accompany the three points that you just made very, very rightly.
Sure. So I'll start out on the fringe.
Okay.
So if we didn't have anything to do with the disruptive technology model, data brokers, there are a bunch right up here just in North Maryland. Each one of those are buying pieces of data from analytics, people that consume analytics over the internet or off of sensor data mm-hmm. or off of wearable technologies. They're buying that data for 50 cents to a dollar per user per month. It's all sitting in these databases. They know more about us than we know about us.
Oh, boy.
You know, there's stories that when you go into Target, they know what you're going to buy before you buy that. It's not a knock on Target, just where we are today in the economy. You could leverage those companies that have all of this information about what the drug companies are coming out with and match that with the information that they already have on citizens, because we all have CVS cards or Rite Aid cards or Target or Walmart.
So then you eliminate the part of the information sharing problem, because that the data analytics part's already built.
Sure.
And it's just a matter of the whatever agencies in government that are pursuing various partnering with the data brokers that have the right information.
Whether it's the FDA, NIH, HHS, if they just looked at the model and said, let's not look at what we've done for 50 years. Let's say day one, let's look forward and how do we solve the problem that clinical trials take way too long and unfortunately people are dying because we're not able to get the folks into the trials. They don't know about it. The process to qualify them takes too long and the consent process. That's just the data broker side for notifications. On the other side of it, there are multiple technologies. I've met with quite a few companies over the past 6 months that have this technology that's available today that are connecting pharmacists, clinical trials, government, as well as the people that are, you know, going to be taking the drugs, and reduces that cycle time immensely and does it all in a secure way. It's out there today. The opportunity and what I would hope that this simple article would spur is, how does the government say, I don't want to do clinical trials the way I used to. I want to do it in a different way.
I think it's a great way to frame this, Keith. I do still have a little bit of a privacy concern, which is a formal concern, and then a delicacy concern, which is informal, because it's a whole lot different for me to leave Target with a coupon for a dollar off a box of protein bars because of predictive analytics than it is for me to receive an email saying, we've learned you may have the markers for Alzheimer's disease.
Right.
Getting the message to the right people is potentially, again, not prohibitive, but a hurdle to consider.
Not saying that there aren't privacy rules that would have to be looked at, but there are, again, going back to this and say, if I want to go through the process and go through the registration and consent and all of that, there are platforms and technologies today that are already secure. And we're going to talk, there's probably 3 to 4 topics we're going to talk about here about the security that's within the federal walls. I would challenge that there are commercial providers that are providing as good, if not better, security that would protect that data. And if the doctor says, Trippy, you have 6 months to live, and I'll probably get that one day, right? Won't we all? I would really hope that privacy sort of concern, I don't care as much about that.
Right.
Have the right drug find me and give me a shot. That's all I want, is a shot.
Keith Trippy's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week is retired Tennessee canine survives cancer thanks to clinical trial. And that's linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. My choice at number 3 is my colleague Jared Serbu's report titled Pentagon Seeks to Hold Its IT Users More Accountable for Cyber Missteps. And I chose this really for one big reason, Keith, and that's a quote. The whole report's terrific. But Terry Halverson, the chief information officer at the Pentagon, had a wonderful quote at this event that Jared covered. What happens if you negligently discharge a firearm? Do you get a little piece of paper that says, please don't do that again? We treat that pretty seriously, and I would argue that the weapon represented by the network is far more dangerous, far more powerful, and can cause us far more damage than a single stray shot from an M16. We've got to raise our accountability level. Now, we didn't get much detail yet on what that might mean. But the fact that they're thinking about it that way says two things to me. One, they're not kidding around. And since DOD is often a marker or a leader for other agencies, if you're leading cyber accountability or cyber efforts at another agency, you should start to watch what Terry's doing in this respect for the same kinds of things that you could do at your agency to hold people accountable for cyber missteps.
Couldn't agree more. I've been watching Terry for years from the outside. Never had the pleasure of working for him, but worked around him. And he's leading in a lot of different areas that is looking at the traditional cyber model and saying, when I say cyber, whether it's the IT model, the deployment model, or the security, and he's saying, no more, right? We need something better. That's not acceptable. What I love about this is now he is tying what has traditionally been viewed as an IT thing, this little network, right, that you people take it, you know, take for granted when they come in the morning, they log in on their computer, and saying it is as dangerous as the discharge of a weapon. And I would argue a vulnerability in the DoD network is far more challenging for DoD than an M16.
I agree.
You know, misfiring.
I agree. I mean, it sounds like he believes that the network is the skeleton on which the muscles and ligaments and organs of the body of the Defense Department are built. I mean, that sounds like that's the priority he wants to attach to it. And that's different than I think we've seen. I think there are a lot of CIOs that believe it. I think there are a lot of CIOs in civilian agencies that don't know that they have the buy-in at that level from their higher-ups, and thus maybe are not as willing to say it in public and talk about accountability as precisely as Terry has been. And that's why I think these comments are very significant. That may give other people, IT leaders in government, at least the opportunity to start to ask questions or have a conversation with the higher level leaders at their organizations.
That's a great point. So the topic of managing up is something that CIOs traditionally, and it's not just over in our federal space, the commercial sector where I've been for the past year, I've had a lot of those discussions. I'm on boards, I've talked to other board members. The dialogue between CISOs and CIOs up through not only the CEOs, but the board members is changing. They're now not only allowed into the room, there's a question that board members are asking every quarter. Now, it's not the most sophisticated question you want, but over the past year, this is what's been are we secure? CISOs typically don't like that question because it's so generic. How do you answer that? That said, at least board people are asking that question, and they're engaging in a level that 2-3 years ago they weren't doing. It seems like Terry has upper management listening to him and saying, I don't care if people complain, we'll buy more earplugs. I love that. That means he's got the support from the brass to go do what he know needs to be done.
It doesn't surprise me because his top boss was ATO when Bill Lynn was the Deputy Secretary of Defense, and Bill spoke very clearly and very articulately and very precisely on cybersecurity, both inside and outside the department when he was there. So it doesn't surprise me that Secretary Carter is giving Terry the kind of cover to be able to go and have these kinds of discussions. My choice at number three on the countdown is from federalnewsradio.com. Pentagon seeks to hold its IT users more accountable for cyber missteps. That's from my colleague Jared Serbu, and you can read it on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Keith Trippi. The Federal News Countdown continues in just a moment. Back to In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Keith Trippi and selected by myself. And Keith, we are up to
number two.
Your choice at number two is from CNET, and the headline is Uber driver is an employee, not a contractor, says the state of California. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say that because your first story, your number three choice was about disruptive technology, you're looking at the potential for something like Uber to work in the federal government. I have an idea, but let me hear what you're thinking about this story in particular.
All right. So for those of you that haven't seen this article yet, what's fascinating about this is it's the clash of traditional government, traditional legal, and a completely consumer-centric disruptive business model that have come together in 2015. That's what's fascinating about this. And the way this precedent reads, the old way of doing business is winning. And here's the nut of it. There's a lady, Miss Berwick, that worked with Uber for 4 months, only 4 months, And for those of you that are familiar with Uber, when you flick the light on, you're driving. When you don't, the light's off.
Yep.
It is 100% your decision. I've yet to meet an employee that has 100% control over what they want to do when they want to do it. Uber provides that luxury. You can choose to drive for them or you don't have to. And even if you are driving for them, if the light's not on, you're not working.
Right.
It's a beautiful business model. Prices have come down for consumers in cities. It's, you know, when I was out in Frisco, you can take a $50 cab ride or you can take Uber for $30. Pretty simple math.
It's and not
it's
bad
safe
for
and
people.
It's secure. Well, the ruling that came down from the California Labor Commission was saying that because they did a background check for consumer safety and because they had issued her a phone, those were a couple of the reasons that they made the case that she is an employee. So here's what that means, folks. $4,300 is or $4,200 is what the Labor Commission is saying that Ms. Berwick is due for those 3 to 4 months that she was working with Uber, not for Uber.
Yes.
She has multiple choices. So what's fascinating about this is the downstream effect that if they do become employees, the valuation on the company is going to drop significantly. It's going to break the business model that Uber has introduced. It's a fascinating case and, unfortunately, a little scary.
The court case says, defendants hold themselves out as nothing more than a neutral technological platform. The reality, however, is defendants are involved in every aspect of the operation. That's the core of the argument about disruptive technology, and it's not limited just to Uber.
Right.
There are other areas that we're starting to see, I think, interestingly, at the federal level, the government itself is trying to foment the disruption with 18F.
Right.
I had Brian Civic in earlier this week talking about the Buyers Club at HHS, which by all accounts has changed the way that that agency is able to start doing things. The White House has sold on it enough that they're requiring it now at every agency across government. And and Brian was very specific about the reasons that that it's different than the way I'm using air quotes for you for the radio listeners.
He is.
The way we've always done things. And so it's interesting that at a state level, or maybe it's the government versus private sector dynamic. I don't know.
I would say it's exactly what it is.
It's a different thing. And so if that's the dynamic you want to look at, it strikes me that the warning here is don't automatically hate it because it's different than what we've seen before.
Right.
Am I on the right track there?
You are spot on the right track. And then the main component of this that's different then I would argue a lot of what I saw in 10 years in the federal space is in the commercial world, you are either a consumer-centric entity or you go out of business. Period. You have to be consumer-centric and you have to be able to manage money, right? Make good investments. That's it. In the federal space, that's not the primary target objective, unfortunately, around a lot of these. So what flew in the face of this model is an individual that had a certain perspective, this Ms. Berwick, is saying, because I feel like I should have been an employee because this is different than other employment models, she was able to sue and convince a group of folks that sided with her. And here's the downstream effect that not only are people, this could potentially ruin what Uber is doing. There are other models, think Kickstarter. Think any of these Expertify. This is this company that does data scientists. It's a platform up in Boston. Any of the data scientists that are on the platform, there are 1,300 of them. When they go out and are outsourced to do work, say they do a job for $5K, are they now suddenly an employee of the group that outsourced, the third party? That's going to entirely break the business model that small to medium businesses are using to outsource capabilities and then make it theirs and go to market. Reduces time to market, reduces complexity, reduces employment overhead. I'll be honest with you, some of this almost seems like there are tax implications. If Uber is now paying tax on a million employees, that's a lot of revenue coming in maybe into a particular state, as opposed to each individual person is responsible for paying their own taxes. So I think, fortunately, there may be a touch point there.
Keith, Trippi's Choice is the second most important federal news story of the week. Is Uber drivers an employee, not a contractor, says California. You can read that at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. My choice at number two is from federalnewsradio.com. Agency says staff cuts taking toll on IRS tax enforcement efforts. And the headline may be a little off because it's technically not an agency. It's the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, the IG that oversees the Internal Revenue Service. And J. Russell George and his team at TIGTA are essentially saying is that the budget cuts that the IRS has lived through for the last 4 or 5 years are hurting revenue collection among people who owe the money, not just among people who may owe the money. And what is striking to me is the juxtaposition of the running a government like a business group, and there are people in Congress who make a good case for why that would work. But I can't identify any business owner that I know that would say the part of the organization that brings the revenue in, we're going to trim that back as much as we possibly can. Now, you and I talked a little bit before we went on the air about politically where this may be coming from. And there's no denying that the IRS has a reputation, at least, whether they deserve it or not, of being very aggressive in some cases about how they go and collect the revenue. That's something that Congress could control. Congress could control through oversight and legislation the means by which and the extent to which that the IRS can go after people who have who owe taxes. There are a lot of laws to that effect on the books already. And you brought up a very good point about the size of the tax code.
Sure. So when you're talking about 50 to 70,000 pages, one of the recommendations here, something certainly to consider, nothing new, would be that when someone is filling out their taxes, I left the government a year ago. It was pretty straightforward before I left. After I left, running my own business, the taxes are far more complicated than what they were before. So now I'm paying a couple, $3,000 a year for accountants and tax attorneys to prepare all of the documentation. Even with them, with the new changes that come in every year and the new additional lines of code, if you will, that are added to the tax, they said it's still very complex for the average tax accountant that's not, say, sitting up on Wall Street to be able to keep up and manage that. So the simplification of the code would certainly help provide some transparency into, is this a nefarious actor who's, you know, willfully neglecting their payment that is owed? Or is it someone that says, my God, I don't know, I'm trying here.
Right. The differentiation involves latitude. And my understanding, again, I'm not an expert on the 50 to 70,000 pages of code either, but my understanding is that the IRS does have that latitude. If they choose to exercise it or fail to exercise it in a way that Congress likes or doesn't like, then the members have a prerogative to look into that, perform oversight, and have done so at various
Well, let me turn this on you, Francis. All right, so say you're on the Hill and you have oversight responsibilities. How do you get transparency into the decision-making process about which, for lack of a better term, this is accounts receivable process?
Yes.
Which accounts do you go after to collect 100%? Which of those accounts do you outsource to some third-party collector to try to catch some of the money? And which do you not go after? How do you provide that transparency through oversight back into the agency?
Well, I'm not in a position to guess which of the buckets the various kinds of accounts go into. But, of course, it requires responsiveness from the agency. That's one of the things that members have complained about. And I'm not here to speak to the compliance or lack of compliance of the Internal Revenue Service, but that's an important component, is understanding in an effective way how the agency goes about performing those collections responsibilities.
I the only thing I would add to that is, again, disruptive technologies. There are technologies that are out there today that are used by large organizations to help manage accounts receivable functions for organizations. They will identify the likelihood of recovery of funds, how much funds can be recovered, how to go about getting those funds. You could leverage outsourcing parties to do that. So you don't have to maybe hire more agency analysts. You can maybe potentially outsource that as a service that's contracted through to the government and then only pay them on results.
Well, I've spoken to Dean Silverman, who until just very recently was a special advisor to John Koskinen at the IRS, and he talked about the efforts that they're using to use data to look for what are the areas that are most likely to yield results,
right,
and try to categorize, okay, if we have noncompliance in this field, in whatever, to be able to predict where those are and predict where to look. So that's the kind of thing that you're talking about. But from a just from a strict business ROI perspective, this passage in this piece, I think, is the most telling. Enforcement revenue collected by the officers dropped from a high of $3.3 billion in 2012 to $3.0 billion last year, even as the economy improved. During that time, the number of revenue officers has been cut by nearly a third to less than 3,000. Now, I'm not suggesting that it is incumbent on Congress to add enough money to restore the entire cadre of agents, because I don't know what the rest of the agency looks like from a human resources perspective and whether you need all of those people doing all of those things. I just don't know.
Sure.
But there's got to be some connection there.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't draw a dollar to human hands connection, there's at least some connection there that's got to be knowable at some point.
I would agree. And I think what would be helpful here is instead of losing the 300 million that was collected last year.
Yes.
One of the things I could focus on is provide some transparency. Where are the assets? Where are their assets today? You started on it, but I'll just pull it out a little bit more. If you look at a zero-based budgeting approach and say the top line is 10 billion
mm-hmm.
for the agency, something like that. In the 10 billion, where are the allocation of resources? Because if they're choosing to spend more money in a particular area than in collections, that's a decision that's made by the secretary.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's something we can
solve
from here.
And it's a solution that could potentially be changed by oversight. You know, mm-hmm. Congress, particularly the House, can tell them, don't spend that there, spend it there.
Right.
But to just arbitrarily, and I know it's not totally arbitrary because right. it's not a salami slice cut, but to cut year after year after year because we don't like how you're doing it, well, let's look at what's happening below the top line. And I have never gotten a sense in any of the coverage of this or any of the discussions with people on the Hill or inside the IRS that that's part of the ongoing discussion.
Yeah, I haven't heard it either. It's a fascinating story.
The second most important federal news story of the week that I've selected is from federalnewsradio.com. Agency says staff cuts take toll on IRS tax enforcement efforts. You can read it and all of the stories from this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by me and Keith Trippi. The Federal News Countdown continues in just a moment. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week. And this week, Keith Trippi of the Trippi Group, formerly at DHS, and I am your other expert choosing the three most important federal news stories of the week. And we are up to
number one.
And Keith, what I propose here is that we talk about both of our number one stories kind of in concert, because OMB will deny. Well, I shouldn't say that because I don't know that they've formally denied that the 30-day cyber sprint that Tony Scott has announced is because of the Office of Personnel Management cyber breaches. But they certainly happened at very coincidental times. Mm-hmm. And so the issue of cybersecurity in government is probably the most critical thing that employees, even if you're not involved in IT, mm-hmm. that employees are thinking about this week. And so I suggest that your choice of number one, OMB orders 30-day cyber sprint to secure agency networks and data by my colleague Jason Miller. And my choice at number one, OPM's lack of transparency on cyber breach leaves feds frustrated and ill-informed, are essentially two sides of the same story. I mean, I think OMB can make a good argument. Hey, this is something we've been working on all along because it's tremendously important. Although it is a little hard to believe that it wasn't accelerated by the chain of events mm-hmm. that we've learned out of OPM. The big issue that I have in as we connect both of these is we know a fair amount about what OMB is proposing for these 30-day sprints. We have very little idea exactly what transpired inside OPM in order to understand what whether those sprints are really addressing the core issues of what caused the breach at OPM, or whether they're just the next generation of what the government and the administration believe is the next correct step to take on cybersecurity, whether that's evolutionary or outcome-based, we don't know.
Right. So I think you'll see a little bit here of what OMB had put out around privileged access. Mm-hmm. I think if you do a little digging there in the OPM, that was a real big problem that they had. I would say that when Snowden hit, a lot of flurry in the government around Snowden, the leaks mm-hmm. that happened. This is kind of the next sort of iteration of that. And so there's been a lot of activity inside the government trying to figure out what can we do to quickly advance some of the agencies that may not be as further along mm-hmm. as we would like them to be. So in reviewing this, okay, good. To get to gooder, one of the things that I wanted to see, and that's an Arkansas term, more gooder.
Very nice.
Where are the outcomes? Not just red, green, yellow. Hey, this is in process.
Right.
It's either done or it's not. And then put the outcomes out there. Publish it so everybody can see what those outcomes are. Business outcomes, cyber outcomes, mission outcomes. Mm-hmm. And frame it in that context. Because when I see improving situational awareness, okay, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. Is that continuous monitoring so I can see it across how many systems and by when? And my mission critical systems first versus, say, business applications. There's some clarity there that I'm sure inside the bowels of the government they're working on, but it's not clear here. Mm-hmm. And I think that gives me a little bit of pause without the outcomes.
I've seen more than one cyber expert say that continuous diagnostics and mitigation, CDM, is terrific, state-of-the-art cybersecurity defense protection for 2007 and not necessarily for 2015. And I'm not enough of an expert to know what that means, but I've seen enough people say it now sure. that I don't think people would just wander around saying if it didn't have some credibility.
Right.
Is it concerning that that's regarded as kind of the next best thing for government cybersecurity in 2015?
Well, you know, years ago, it was compliance, compliance, compliance. Mm-hmm. And as I used to tell one of the old CISOs I worked with, I really don't think China cares that I've got a 3-year ATO that's, here's my paperwork that says that I have that. So I think part of what will come out of this is compliance will start to move down the food chain of prioritization, and then execution operations, having transparency and visibility into the information. Yeah, I tell you, there's two other things that are missing here that I wanted to point out. Number one, this is an edict for our good friends over in this CISO office, as well as some system owners and the CIOs.
Mm-hmm.
Where are our friends in contracting? So where are the edict, where are the performance outcomes for chief procurement office? Because let me tell you how this works inside the government. All of the contracts that exist today that are hosting these systems, none of them have provisions that say, if we get zapped, I'm cutting your contract off tomorrow, no ifs, ands, or buts, and then maybe I'll come back and look for restitution. None mm-hmm. of that's in those. Even if that were in those contracts, this breach happens, all of the changes that are going to have to happen to do patch management, configuration management, visibility into the systems, all of those are going to require extensive contract changes across a lot of the IT systems in the government. Where are the where's the CPO's edict to directly support and prioritize this work over other work? It's the end of the federal year, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where is this being prioritized for our contracts officers?
That's a question that we'll have to leave for another time because I unfortunately, in the situation we're in today, I think the answer is obvious. And when we come back, I want to get into this transparency issue, both on the 30-day sprint side mm-hmm. and on the communications with employees side. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by myself and by Keith Trippi, and more discussion of the OPM cybersecurity breach as the most important story of the week when we come back on the Federal News Countdown. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Keith Trippi of the Trippi Group and selected by yours truly. And both our number one stories this week revolved somewhat around, well, at least around the broad concept of cybersecurity in government, and perhaps around the issue of the cyber breach at the Office of Personnel Management. My colleague Jason Miller's story, OMB Orders 30-Day Cyber Sprint, is Keith's choice at number one. And my choice at number one is my colleague Mike O'Connell's report on federalnewsradio.com, headlined OPM's Lack of Transparency on Cyber Breach Leaves Feds Frustrated and Ill-Informed. And I guess the reason that I thought it was most striking, we did a survey on federalnewsradio.com. How would you rate OPM's communication with current and former feds about the data breach? And we screened out that it was only people actually affected. So it would be only current and former feds whose answers we took.
Of which I'm in that group.
All right. 953 people answered. So it's not a small sample size. The choices were excellent, good, fair, poor, don't know, not sure. Poor, 78% of the respondents thought that OPM's communication was poor.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just me. I mean, right. I know you saw my commentary, sure, and commented on that, mm-hmm, on federalnewsradio.com. And that's how I would have rated it. Mm-hmm. And I'm apparently not the only one.
So, you know, 11 years in the system, been out a little over a year. I would say you missed another opportunity. What would be below poor?
Poorer than poor.
I would fill that one out.
Wow.
Look, you know, when it first came out, I still haven't got notified.
None.
Don't know.
No notification at all?
If you read this article, haven't been notified, don't know what I'm supposed to do, don't know what I'm going to get for protections and the identity guard or whatever that is that they're going to cut. Don't have it. Still haven't got it. I've only been gone a year and a half.
Well, don't feel lonely, because Mike's story says, asked whether OPM's information was helpful, only 10% said they understood what happened and what they should do next. Right. Most respondents either said they had no idea what was happening or what they should do, 33%, or thought they understood but weren't sure what they should do next, 31%.
Sure.
The part of this that flummoxed me completely, mm-hmm, and I wrote about this in the commentary, was... So one of the things, you and I have talked about phishing attacks before. Mm-hmm. Every cyber person that I talk to, right, talks about phishing attacks. So what was the response from OPM? They sent emails to people, right, with links to all kinds of stuff. Here's a link to the FTC's website. Right. Here's a link to this and a link, right, to that and a link to the other thing. And they sent in your email a PIN number you were supposed to, mm-hmm, use, and a link to click to enter your PIN number at a website of a contractor that didn't have anything to do with the Office of Personnel Management. Now, sure, I don't know the people at this company, CSID. I'm, right, sure they're lovely, wonderful people. Right. I'm not casting aspersions on them as a business. Mm-hmm. But the execution here was just terrible.
Right.
It was contrary to everything that everybody tries to train federal employees. Don't do this.
Right.
Don't click on links that come to your work email address, mm-hmm, that have links to sites that you're not familiar, right, with. Don't click on links in emails and enter personal information into those links. It boggled, yep, my mind, Keith.
Let me give you over a month ago, I picked up a phone call in the afternoon, and this is directly, I don't know if it's directly related to this story, but this is something that someone less sophisticated and didn't run a cyber division probably would have missed.
Mm-hmm.
Someone called up and said, are you Keith Trippi, and do you work with so-and-so? And I sat the first thing, I said, well, who is this? And then they hung up.
Uh-huh.
Not a week later, I got an email from the email address of a executive I work with at an entirely different company.
Yeah.
His exact email address. I had talked to him 3 hours earlier that day,
mm-hmm,
and in it said, hey, Keith, I uploaded a file for you.
Oh.
I kid you not.
Wow.
It was 9:30 at night, been gone all day, worked late. I almost mm-hmm, clicked that button.
Yep.
Now, what is someone going to do that works in the CFO office or someone out in the field that hasn't managed a cyber bit? I didn't open it.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't click on the button. How many other people are going to do that?
Tons.
Now, I don't know if it's tied to this or not, but that's a potential downstream impact. Could be 6 months from now, could be 3 years from now.
You know, that's the biggest complaint that I've heard from people is, you're going to buy me credit monitoring and identity protection for 18 months.
Yep.
it should be for the rest of people's lives, because that's how long this is going to affect. And please don't tell me that the people that are paying attention to this and are clever enough to send you an email like mm-hmm. that have not figured out that 18 months from now, February of 2017, is going to be the ideal time to start these attacks
on
people.
You bet.
Because they'll know the identity protections run out. I mean, this is it's starting to get into the level of silliness, it seems to me.
And
am I being too hard on
you? You are spot on. And the American culture is, I want it and I want it now. And so that means if something happens a couple months from now, I'll already have forgotten. There are bad actors that are out there today that think in decades and dynasties.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. And I went into Target 3 days after the breach with a big wad of cash in my pocket because there was no way I was scanning a credit card. And people were just scanning like crazy, boy.
Sure. Back to normal.
Yeah, just like nothing ever happened.
Yep.
3 days after one of the biggest breaches in retail history. All right. Now you've got me fired up. Thanks for nothing.
You're frothing.
Oh, man. Keith Trippi's choice is the most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. Jason Miller's story, OMB orders 30-day cyber sprint to secure agency networks and data. My choice at number one is OPM's lack of transparency on cyber breach leaves feds frustrated and ill-informed. All of the stories from the countdown are linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. It's wonderful to see you, my friend.
My friend,
thank you very much for coming in to do the Federal News Countdown. And you can hear the entire program and see all the links at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Next week's Federal News Countdown returns next Friday.